right. Welcome back, everybody. Today, we're going to be talking about the Van Gogh job, and I have Lisa Lynn back with me.
Hey, y'all.
So this episode aired on July 17th, 2011. It was so important that it was directed by John Rogers himself, and it was written by Chris Downey. So they
now,
were like,
this isn't John's directorial debut, is it?
No.
No, I think his first one was The Inside Job. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
But he's still pretty new to it. But he's pretty proud of him. Sorry. He's pretty proud of himself for the work that he did in this one, which makes sense. There's some really beautiful, beautiful scenes in this episode.
He should be. And the timeline is pretty tricky since it moves back and forth. So there's a lot of moving parts. And for a newbie, he did good.
Yeah. So in this episode, to protect a World War II veteran and solve the decades-old mystery of a missing Van Gogh, the team spends a lot of time delving into the past, or delving into a past that looks awfully familiar. I love it. Like, the roller rink where we start out is
It's very nostalgic, because I feel like you can't find a roller rink these days. Like a bowling alley or an ice skating rink. They're all gone.
Yeah, it's really picturesque. It's in a place called Oaks Park, which is a really, really old amusement park that in Portland that's like from 1901, 1902 or something.
How does Portland have everything?
I don't know.
Literally, but anything the show needs, Portland has it. Like,
I know, that's why we moved there. Yeah, so that's definitely on our list of places that we need to go when we're on our podcast trip to Portland. If you look really closely in a scene later when they're standing outside of the roller rink, it's like reflected in the glass of the doors. You can see the carnival, like the amusement park rides from the carnival job that we'll have later in the series, this season. Huge thing for this episode is that they got freaking Danny Glover to guest star, which is like, kind of huge.
I mean, I'm sure all of them were freaking out.
Yeah, I mean, yeah. Beth Rieskraft was like, got to film all of her parts of them. He came in, apparently, like he flew from like New York or something, on a red eye, and he came in and he was tired, but then he just like banged out all of his scenes really quick. And he was just like, it was like a masterclass apparently to work with him.
Aww.
Yeah, they said so many nice things about him in the commentary.
I apologize, Mr. Glover, but I mostly know him from, like, I'm too old for this shit, like the Lethal Weapon movies.
Yeah.
I am sure he has like a very, like, you know, decorated and noteworthy career, but I just mostly know him as, like, the I'm too old for this shit guy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think... You know, he bought a house or three on that line. So I think he's happy with that. It's okay. But yeah, so we open up with Danny Glover's character, whose name is Charles Lawson, and he's reminiscing about the old days in this old roller rink with this guy who just shows up. But it turns out he's a goon who...
I feel like the lighting in this scene in the beginning, it's like, it almost has like a mystical, like... dreamy quality to it. Like, that's something with the light. There's like a subtle, like, golden light to the whole thing. It just like felt very dreamy and nostalgic, and like, which fits in with this old timey setting, because this is like an old timey setting.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't, I feel like I want to call this like Leverage's first AU episode, alternate universe episode. Like,
yeah.
It is and isn't, but you know?
Yeah, no, it totally, I think. Yeah, I can see it that way. It's their first time that they're really, like, working with, like, that different of a timeline, too. We have a lot of flashbacks in Leverage, but not quite this far flashing back.
Mm.
And then kind of not playing with, like, an unreliable narrator, but it's not that. It's, like, an unreliable person who's hearing the story and then filtering it later.
Almost like a telephone-type situation.
Yeah, or just, you know, when you hear a story and you can relate it to your life and it makes it more important to you because you can relate it to your life.
there.
But I agree, like every scene in the Roller Palace, it's got to be something to do with like the old, you know, just everything in the air and the way the light filters in, you know, through like the dust particles and stuff. But it is a magical place.
Yes.
So, but yeah, he's standing there and like, oh, you should have seen this place in the 40s.
In his heyday.
Yeah. And it turns out the guy who's talking to him is like a goon who's like, where's the painting, Lawson? And I love him. He's just like, his face turns from like, oh, reminiscing to like, kind of like a hard ass, and he's not scared of this guy at all, and he's like, don't wave that fake dollar store badge in my face. And
which just reminded me of the double blind job in the beginning when like Hardison and Elliot are coming out of the coffee shop and then their client literally runs into them. And then the guys after her were pretending to be FBI agents, and then Hardison was just like, those are bad, like, first of all, those are a crappy, like, fake-ass, like, badges, and I'm insulted. And second, you spilled his coffee. So, yeah. Like, bad guys, you need to up your game, get better badges if you want to, like, try to mess with people. Get better badges.
And, like, do your research on who you're threatening, because a lot of people, that's gonna work. But this guy, apparently, it doesn't faze him at all. But then the guy leaves and he has like some sort of cardiac episode or a heart attack or something, and he falls down.
And like in the music, there is a heartbeat. You hear a heartbeat.
Mm, yeah.
So.
Yeah.
Like to telegraph, this is serious. He's.
Yes, this is important. and then we see Nate coming into the bar with what we find out is a former coworker. And I love, they're already like mid conversation when they're walking in, and he's like, you know, you were like the best, you caught, you know, you were really good at your job. Like, and he's like, oh, except for me, I was better than you at IYS.
Which is such a Nathan Ford thing to say.
Oh yeah. But I do so love knowing that means Sterling was not first or second. He was at least third. That makes me really happy.
You know, I'm gonna pick a bone, and I probably think maybe Nate is lying to make this guy feel better, because I honestly feel like Sterling is probably second. Sterling is just too ambitious to settle, like to be okay with being third. Like, he's.
Well, yeah, that's why he clawed his way up, but. I can see that's part of why he's like so bitchy, is that he's third. But this guy has been fired. He's been let go because he's been obsessed with finding this missing Van Gogh painting that went missing during World War II. It's a self-portrait of Van Gogh. We'll talk about that a little more in a little bit. But
yeah,
it turns out that he's found some new evidence about a soldier who had, you know, taken it out of the museum, and you know, he was gonna make his money with that. So he's like, oh, and then they think that it came to the U.S. with a GI after the war.
This is our second Nazi art episode, Steve. Our second Nazi art episode.
Oh my gosh, it is. Well, there's so much, like, that is, I mean, you could have an entire show that's just the Leverage crew saving pieces that were looted.
Like, recovering Nazi art, stolen Nazi art.
So much stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh. Yeah, so, and Nate's like, well, you know, I'm not really in the art retrieval business anymore, so I don't know why you're coming to me. And he says, Nate, the Billionaires Club has heard about this. They found out they're going to come after this guy, and they don't care.
So the Billionaires Club hired the goon who was threatening Danny Glover.
Yeah. So oh. Yeah, we've already seen that somebody's, you know, already ready to do some, you know, dirty business to try to get this painting. And then I love, we get to see Nate and Sophie kind of talking shop. About their time before, and I always love when they, like, you get these little hints at everybody's past, because she said, you know, I thought I found it one time in Tokyo, but it was a fake. And he's like, oh yeah, I looked for it too and, you know, never found it. And Elliot comes in and he's like, you know, where is everybody? And it turns out that Hardison and Parker have been sent ahead, and they've actually, they're telling us it's Oregon too. Like, they're not even lying about where this place is. They're like, oh, we sent them ahead. And they run the explanation at the beginning, and Sophie talks about,
oh, the exposition dumping about the painting.
Yeah. Yeah. Instead of Hardison
running the clicker.
Yeah. But it's cool. They have like a little touch screen and it feels really, you know, cutting edge technology. And
Elliot, I feel like that was just Christian, like just having fun, like manipulating the screen. That wasn't even Elliot. That was just Christian.
He's like, oh, I don't know what this is. Which is great because then Nate gets to, you know, be like, no, don't stop.
See, that's where the mom and dad and like the kids thing, like that is so him telling a dad, like a dad telling him, no.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And Elliot's like, what? He's always telling me to like get better at technological stuff. And Nate's like, that's never gonna happen. Which, not with that attitude, it's not, Nathan.
But that was mean. You don't say that to a kid. You believe in your child.
He's always mean.
But I think to go back to what you're saying at the beginning, at the top of this, it's kind of interesting how they all came in, like you said, with their expertise. Like Sophie with her art, that is her alley. You know, I mean, Parker with the breaking and entering, but like Elliot later on.
Enter at all.
Yeah. I mean, I guess one of them taking over the tech, but like going over the history of it, the art, like, you know, sale, which is like Nate's thing. And then later on, Nate's like, okay, this is your thing with the retrieval. Like, how does this work?
Yeah, it's like right now when he asks them about it.
Yeah.
And we see a lot of, I mean, last season we have a lot of Elliot's past coming to light, but this is just like, you kind of see who he worked with on kind of a day-to-day basis.
And then like he was kind of vague and cryptic, but that makes it all the more menacing because he's like, and Sophie's like, this stuff could put, like, based on the market and the auctions, $100 million. And he's like, we're looking at a 10% cut. What do you think a purse guy's think, what a guy's willing to do for $10 million?
Yeah.
You know?
And that, you know, a lot. So Mr. Watson is definitely in danger. So then we cut to Hardison and Parker are already at the hospital where he's recovering. And, you know, they're watching, keeping an eye on him so nobody messes with them. Mm-hmm. And, she's like trying to give him books, but he doesn't want any. And then he's like, actually, I got to get out of here. And she breaks cover really fast and is like, don't worry, Mr. Lawson, like, we're here to keep you safe. We're not going to let anything happen to
you. This is very interesting that Parker, I think it was in the snow job and the thing, like, she, like, plays a nurse. And then in the miracle job, to keep Nate's priest, like, D.B. Sweeney, in the hospital, she had to play a nurse. Like, Parker plays nurse a lot, actually, now that we think about it.
Mm-hmm.
Huh. And, like, of all the team, the one who's, like, least suited to, like, nursing. Like,
well, I didn't take her as a nurse. I took her as a volunteer because I don't know if the nurses go around with books.
Like a candy striper thing. Like, yeah. You want books, candy? I have a teddy bear. If you want to cuddle a teddy bear, if that would make you feel better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I took her as like just a hospital volunteer.
Mm.
But yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's an easy thing to, you know, go in as in a hospital. There's lots of nurses. Nobody looks twice at you.
People, I mean, you just wear a scrub and harness and can fake a badge and you're fine.
Yeah. Yeah. It just seems, it's just a really easy cover.
Yeah.
But yeah, so she tells him, you know, hey, we're here to help you. Don't worry. And he sees her and Hardison interact a little. And he's like, oh, he's suspicious of them, but you like looking at them, he's like, okay, because Hardison has had to go through the the archives or the
records. And he was being very partisan, complaining about dust mites and upper respiratory issues.
He's so cute, and he sneezes, and she gives him a tissue. And he's like, you know my allergies, and she's like, yeah, I know. And, which this is just, you know, they know each other. She knows his ailments and stuff.
Hardison just needs to complain and get it out of his system. Just like Elliot just sometimes just needs to growl and be stupid and grumpy and get it out of his system. It's just exactly. It's just what they do.
Exactly. So yeah, so we find out that he doesn't find much on Lawson, that, you know, he grew up here. It's his first time back since the war, basically. And he's traveled all around.
He was in the European theater.
So. Yeah. And he, you know, he lived in France. He lived in Australia. He lived in Botswana. He just like moved around the world working in different places. And this is his first time back since then. And they're not really sure why he's there. And Nate and Sophie, when they get to the hospital pretty fast, but I think it's probably the next day, and they're trying to convince Lawson to tell them where the painting is, and he doesn't want to talk to them, which makes sense. He hasn't told anybody where this is for, you know, 50 something years, maybe 60 years. A fun point, this guy's supposed to be 88 years young, but Danny Glover was like 20 years younger than that.
Well, ageism is an ugly thing, Steve. Ageism is an ugly thing.
It is. He just, you know. But yeah, so he refuses to tell them anything. And, you know, Nate and Sophie were like, all right, well, we're not going to push it and have this guy crack. So they start to head out. But Parker is upset. She's like, we can't just leave him in danger. And she grabs Hardison's hand. She's like, we can't just.
Which I saw as a huge character development.
Oh, yeah.
Especially from season one. Season one, Parker would have been like, God, thank God I don't have to be around people anymore. Let's go.
Yeah. Yeah. This season is a lot of Parker. Well, and last season, too, we're seeing so much Parker growth.
Yeah. She and cares. Parker cares.
And she cares. Like, I mean, we're seeing it like little ways, like, she knows about Hardison's allergies, and that she cares that this guy might get hurt. Because it's not even like, whatever, if we find this painting
like,
or not.
Like, Sophie was like, our baby's all grown up. That's our baby. Yeah.
But when Lawson sees her interacting with Hardison again, he changes his mind and he says, okay, I'll talk, but I only want to talk to her, meaning Parker. And then we get to see her freak out because she's like, oh my God, I don't know how to do this. This is more Sophie than me. What do I? And she's like running through different cons that she can do. And Nate's like, just listen to him.
Calm down. You can do this. Which again is more like, which was like, oh, like Parker cares. She wants to do a good job. She doesn't want to mess it up. She wants to help and do the right thing, which is so different from season one versus season two Parker. Season two, yeah. A little bit of, okay, what do I have to do to fake this? But she cares.
Yeah, we, you know, in the first episode of season four, The Long Way Down Job, you know, it is like physically painful that she can't do the right thing, like what she thinks is the right thing. And, you know, Elliot has to have that kind of come to Jesus talk with her. But here, the right thing is pretty easy to do physically, but it's hard to do emotionally. And she's going to have to sit down and like, let this guy talk at her without being active, without doing something concrete. It's precious. But meanwhile, Elliot heads over to Lawson's childhood home and he's pretending that he's got to check for a gas leak. And he's like, oh, I got to check the LOL levels.
And for some reason, he decides his name is Lucas. Like, that is the name on his, like, uniform.
Oh, yeah, I didn't see that. And she's like, oh,
like, you can tell he's just like half-assing it. He's just making the stuff up. Like, he's done no prep for this character. He's like, okay, I just got to get into this woman's house. Okay, fine. I'll pretend to be the gas guy. Whatever. Let's do this.
Yeah, well, to me, and especially this next thing that you hear, it's just like, this is just, what's the metaphor I want to use? The like loosening of the jam jar, right? Like that, like that's just one of the preliminary steps that he probably took in every single job as a retrieval specialist. Because when he like finishes giving his spiel, she's like, oh yeah, you can head in the back. The mold guy is already back there.
Like, and I mean, unless you don't have a gas, you don't use gas. If someone like says, I'm from the gas company and I think we got a report of a leak, can we come in? You're like, I don't want to die of poisoning. Please come in, you know?
And he didn't even immediately ask to go in her house. He wanted to go in the back and check.
Yeah.
So, like, in that case, I'd be like, well, yeah, I guess you can check the backyard. Like, that's fine.
I think that is where the Sophie Grifter thing comes in. Like, he's talking. He's being like, oh, hi, how are you? Ooh, these levels look bad. Like, he's establishing, like, a rapport with the Mark. Like, trying to get her on his side so she will do what he wants. Like, he's saying things that sound like technical jargon, so he's sounding somewhat legit, like making it believable, making her believe that he is actually the gas company guy.
Yeah.
You know?
But what I'm saying is, I think that he did this way before he ever met Sophie. Like, I think this was part of what he did as a retrieval specialist, because there's already somebody else who's doing the same thing. And the minute she says, oh, the mold guy is in the back.
So there's probably, you know, it's probably in like the weather retrieval specialist playbook.
Because he knows, he's like, oh, is he? And he goes back and he knows the guy. It's Frank. He's like, Frank, what are you doing? And Frank is the guy who was threatening Lawson at the beginning.
He's running into a number of old co-workers, these old colleagues in this episode, I must say.
It's people who are doing his job. Makes total sense.
I guess it's a small world. All the retrieval specialists know each other.
All the good ones, anyways. But yeah, I love, like, he shows up back there and he's like, Frank. And Frank's like, I'm here to get paid. And he has like a baton. And Elliot picks up the first thing that comes to hand, which is a pink baseball bat, like a kid's baseball bat. And he's like, oh, did you get that at Barbie's dream house?
Oh God.
Which is the dumbest thing to say. But also, this might be my favorite part of the whole episode, is just Christian Elliot's very disappointed voice. So he's just like, Frank, like, I'm gonna beat the shit out of you with this pink baseball bat, and your toxic masculinity is gonna be one of the things I'm gonna try to beat out of you. Like, do you think because it's pink it's not gonna hurt as much? Like, God, Frank, Jesus.
Like, he can make a weapon out of anything.
I know. Just the Frank. So good. But as they're about to start fighting for real, the owner comes out and Frank gets freaked out and jumps over the fence and runs away.
Which is, you know, not at all suspicious. Not at all suspicious.
He's like, oh yeah, the mold guy just left. He said you're good. And he says, you know, I need to know how old the house is. Do you have anything that's original, like any features or anything? And she says, no, but oh, there was some art that I found in the house when I moved in. And he's like, huh?
That'll work.
Oh, well,
it's like,
just so happens I'm looking for art.
But how would that help?
How would art help?
I mean, like, he was saying, I need to know, like, some about the fixtures, the date of the house. Like, how would old artwork help?
I don't know.
The art could have been purchased anytime. So I don't know how that would have been relevant to his question. I mean, obviously, it's moved the plot along, but.
Yeah, especially if it is the missing Van Gogh, which was painted in, like, 1888.
I mean,
I don't think this house is that old.
So, you know, I mean, so, I mean,
all she's just trying to help. She just wants to please this strange, beautiful man in her backyard.
Fine, whatever.
Yeah. where were we?
Yeah, she's mentioning, okay, I have some help artwork that will somehow magically help him find, like, date the house so he knows maybe what fixtures to look at.
And yes.
Then, and Elliot's basically like, oh, that'll work.
Yeah, and then it switches over to, we see Lawson starting to tell Parker his story about, you know, growing up in this town and being at the Roller Palace where he meets Dorothy Ross.
This is where we get into the alternate universe AU. Yeah.
So, and I love this because, like, the first thing we see is them as little kids.
And so cute. So adorable. So cute.
I tried to look on IMDb to see who the boy is who plays young Charlie Lawson because he is, like, the cutest child. And he's not credited. So if anybody knows who he is, please tell me because I want to look him up and see what he's doing now because he was... I mean, he might have just been, like, a local Portland actor, but he's so cute.
Or maybe just, like, the son or nephew of, like, a crew member who was there who was, like, who was just randomly available.
Maybe. He should have been credited. But, yeah, so he's known this girl, Dorothy Ross, like, his whole life. She's the daughter of the lumber baron who basically owns this town. And
but the epitome of poor little rich girl, literally.
Yeah.
Poor little rich girl.
Yeah. And so, you know, Parker asks about her and he's just like, oh, she was stubborn as a mule. And her dad wanted her to be like a society girl, but she wasn't into that. And she would get her like Wurlitzer lessons on the Wurlitzer, the organ at the palace.
So is a Wurlitzer like an actual like separate thing, or is it just a huge-ass fancy organ?
I think it's just a huge-ass fancy organ.
Okay.
But let me see. I always assumed that it was, like, the brand?
Yeah, like a brand name, like, you know, like a Steinway piano or a
Yamaha piano. So let's see. Yeah, it's a company. I'm going to read from the Wikipedia article. The Rudolf Wurlitzer Company, usually referred to as simply Wurlitzer, is an American company started in Cincinnati in 1853 by German immigrant Franz Rudolf Wurlitzer. The company initially imported stringed woodwind and brass instruments from Germany for resale in the United States.
So
yeah, they quickly expanded to make band organs, orchestrions, player pianos, and pipe or theater organs popular in theaters during the days of silent movies. So, yeah, so they made a lot of organs and things.
So just a particular brand of a huge-ass fancy organ.
Yeah.
Okay.
And, yeah, she would get her lessons on the big organ there, which I think is hilarious.
Aw. Also, like, props to hair and makeup and wardrobe, like the 40s hairstyle that they did on Beth and the wardrobe. Amazing.
Yeah. And I love that. And he says, you know, when we were little kids, I thought, you know, she had everything and her life was perfect. But as we got older, I realized she was just as trapped as I was. You're like, oh. And then, yeah, we see Parker has imagined Dorothy and Charlie as herself and Hardison. And yeah, the clothes are amazing. So
like so vintage, like yeah. My author friend Lenora Bell, like she would wear the shit out of that. That is her aesthetic, like all the way.
Yeah. The costume, the head of costuming for Leverage, Nadine Hayter, she is so good, and she spent a lot of time on this episode. If you notice, every outfit in the 40s scenes comes from the color palette of the painting, of the Van Gogh painting, so it's lots of greens and yellows and browns, and she just, like, really made sure to, like, stay with that, like, aesthetic.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And it's not like, it doesn't like kick you in the face, but once you notice that, you're like, oh.
The woman is brilliant.
Yeah. She's so good.
I know, like, I've read John's blog and I've listened to some of the commentaries and they love them so Nadine. They give her prop. They give her props like all the time. Like she, like she's a miracle worker. And she, all the time they're like, I don't know what she's doing on a low budget show like ours, but we're keeping her. They gotta be have her, you know?
Right? Yeah, she's fabulous. But okay, let's see, where were we? Yeah.
It's those like touches that attention to detail that is amazing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So right after this, you know, we kind of see our first shot of Parker and Hardison in the past. Like Hardison as Charlie is so cute.
So charming.
They're, like, talking about like where they want to travel if they could go anywhere in the world, and he's just like this. The Empire State Building, like, come on, you can go anywhere.
Like, and dream bigger.
Yeah. She's like, well, I've never been there. And Parker uses that, like, mid-Atlantic or transatlantic, whatever it's called, that, like, very 1940s Hollywood starlet cadence and accent. Yeah. That was, like, a very trained thing at the time. Which I think is so, it's almost jarring because you're used to how Parker talks. And
it's more, like, it's a more, Park, yeah, it's a different, it's a different flow. It's a different cadence. Yeah. And yeah, it harkens back to those, like you said, that era, that golden age of Hollywood era, like Garbo, Bacall, Hepburn, you know.
Yeah.
All those amazing, Ingrid Bergman, all those amazing leading ladies.
Yeah. And even Aldous's voice is different because he's trying to like kind of match Danny Glover's cadence.
And a little lower, a little bit of a rasp.
Yeah. And he's got like a different like lilt to his voice too. And you're like, okay. I like it.
I mean, I'm just trying to picture how Aldous felt. He's like, wait, I have to play a young Danny Glover? Are you kidding me?
I mean, worse things could happen to you.
We all must suffer for our art.
Yeah. Then it jumps back to Elliot at the house, and it turns out that it's too early in the episode for this to happen anyways, but it was not the painting we're looking for. It turns out that the painting the lady, or the artwork that the lady found is this collage of Paris, and it's like a collage that Charlie had made as a kid or as a teen. You're just like, oh, he's always wanted to travel.
I mean, this may be horrible, like stereotypical and inappropriate for me to say, but like for someone in that era to dream like that, like that is, you know?
Yeah.
To think that, why not? Why can't I go to Paris if I want to go to Paris?
Exactly. I love that. Hang on.
Exactly.
Yeah, you're right. It's not something that you see portrayed in media very often.
No.
And it obviously can't be, you know, like a fictional, like one-off thing. Like people have dreams. Like
obviously. And it doesn't matter.
You know, kind of what state they're in. Everybody has dreams. They're all different, but everyone has big things they'd love to do for themselves. And I love that this show is like, you know what? We're going to show this.
Yeah.
And we're also going to show the dark side of Oregon. We'll talk about in just a second.
I thought that was interesting, but it was Parker's character, the Dorothy character, who has small hometown dreams. I just want to go to the Empire State Building. And the Charlie Lawson is the one who wants to, let's go see the world. Let's go see the Eiffel Tower. Let's go see the Taj Mahal. Like, that is an awesome, amazing contrast. Yeah. Almost like flipping it on its head, almost.
Yeah. But they have this super sweet conversation where they're talking about going to Paris. And so she starts taking French lessons and then turns around and is teaching him French. And he picked it up really quickly. And he's like, we should go to Paris together. And he says that he made it sound like a joke so he could take it back if she got offended. But she's like, oh, I'd really love that. And it's so
like, we all knew he meant it. We all knew he wasn't just kidding. Let's go to Paris. Like, girl, let's go to Paris.
Yeah. Like right now, let's go. But then her dad shows up and she's like, oh, he picked up my book for me. We're just alone in this roller rink. And he,
you said, the dark side of Oregon.
Yeah. And he says, it wasn't Kentucky, but it was a white woman and a black man was illegal in the 1940s. And I thought this was, so Portland is always, when you think about Portland, everyone thinks it's this, it's Portlandia. It's like all
progressive.
Super progressive. But it's not like Portland is really segregated and it has had a lot of issues like in the past and all the way today with lots of racism.
Like the black folks on my Twitter timeline, they're like, yeah, and there's a reason. Like it was a place where white people wanted to escape people like who look like me. So that's why. And they're and there are a lot of neo-Nazis and white nationalists and stuff up there in the Pacific Northwest.
Yeah.
There's some downtowns out west, out in Oregon and Washington, and it's like, damn.
Yeah. I mean, talk about white flight.
Literally.
Trying to get up on the other end of the country. So I think that's really easy to forget because, Portland and Seattle and that whole area feels really progressive and really like hipstery.
But it's not that utopia. It's not that haven. No.
It's not. And don't fall into that trap. No. Yeah. So he thinks he gets away with hanging out with her, but some thugs show up to beat him up.
And her daddy sent her some goons after him.
Yeah. And, just so we don't forget that this man runs this town and he's got eyes and ears everywhere. But luckily, the sheriff shows up and points a gun at this guy inside the roller rink. And I never remember his name. I just call him Sheriff Not Nate. Because Parker sees him as Nate.
I want to say, I think his name is Tom something at this point. It's probably Tom something.
Probably is, but Sheriff Not Nate.
Okay.
And he, he
called him, we call Judge Evil Ron Butterfield, so we don't have to real know.
That's right. Yeah, we can call anybody whatever we want.
Yes.
This is our podcast.
Yeah, but we need to back, when Aldous was, bringing the French, that was something.
It was very nice.
And I feel like his accent was good, too.
I think so. Yeah. Also, it is, one of my favorite tropes when, someone's learning a language and then the other person that they're speaking with doesn't understand and then they say something, revealing that they know that person can't understand. When they, they tell them, they love them or whatever. It's like that scene in 10 Things I Hate About You. When she gets
there was that scene, oh my god, almost 10 years ago, Jada Pinkett Smith had this show on TNT around the same time, Hawthorne, where she plays a nurse, and Michael Vartan would play the doctor, and they're just having this pizza dinner, and then she's like, tell me something I don't know about. So he starts bringing the French, because actually Michael Vartan was born in France, so he speaks French, and he's saying stuff like, I was born in French, my dad still lives there. And he's like, and then she's like, oh, I didn't know you spoke French. And then she just kind of gives a little smile, keeps talking. I think you're beautiful and wonderful and marvelous. And then she's like, well, what does that mean? It means I have surgery in about 30 minutes. So I probably need to go, in 2 hours. So I probably need to go home and rest. He's like.
Yeah, no, I love that trope. I don't think he did it here because he tells her what he said.
No, he just, whatever sentence she's saying, he just said it in French.
Well, then he keeps saying something. He says, languages come easily to me or something.
Yeah.
But yeah, I like to imagine that he was saying random things to her and she was like, what? What are you saying? And nobody else can understand French in this little tiny town. So he could be professing his love to her, and it would have been fine. But so Sheriff Not Nate, you know, shows up and he stands up for him, but then he warns him that he's heading off to training and he's going to go off to the war, and the deputies he's leaving behind aren't going to help him. They don't know him.
They're going to listen to Daddy.
Yeah. So, and this is like heartbreaking because he goes, you know, I realized that I needed to do something to change Mr. Ross's mind about me. So he enlists, and I'm like,
oh, honey,
not only like you said, is this guy like have these big dreams, but he also has this optimism that he's going to freaking change this like rich old white man's mind about him.
Oh,
and his
honey, like, institutionalization. Bless like, your heart. Oh, honey.
Which makes it like even worse later. You're just like,
oh, you poor summer child.
Right. So he enlists, he doesn't even tell Dorothy, he's just like up and leaves. And her face when that girl tells her in the rink is like heartbreaking because she's like trying to keep it together because she's in public. She's like, oh, and then so we hear like,
you know, patriotism, the war effort and all that.
Yeah, like, oh, I'm proud that he's going off to serve our country, but he left without telling me he could die and I might never see him again.
Yeah.
All like warring on her face at the same time while she's wearing a really cute dress.
Craft is such an amazing job in this episode. Like,
yeah,
she's really good.
She's really good. So in the army, he, because he's a black soldier, there's not a lot that he can do. But he drives a supply truck, and because he speaks French, he can, you know, get wine. Like,
I mean, they found him useful because he could translate, basically. Yeah.
And after D-Day, they're out in the French countryside clearing out pockets of Germans. And while they've stopped, because he needs to, like, refill some ammo and get a fresh live grenade from his supplies, this woman like runs out of the woods and is like yelling in French.
And then it was the scene where he's driving the truck and there's like a literal crate of like French wine next to it, which I thought was like the best thing ever.
Yeah, because that's proof of like how he could use his, well, it's first it's proof of him using his French skills, and then second it comes in handy in a minute. But yeah, this woman like runs out of the woods and she's like yelling in French, and then we see Elliot. who's Charlie's commanding officer.
Not Elliot.
But yeah, not Elliot. And he doesn't understand the French, but Charlie saves his life because she's like, she's saying, crouch, get down, get down. And there's a sniper up in the trees.
Aww.
And, you know, they're trying to take cover and figure out where this guy's at. And the guy that Charlie had been supposed to give ammunition and a live grenade to was like, losing his mind and can't do anything, so Charlie uses like the bullet hole in the windshield of the truck and the broken glass of one of the wine bottles to like line up the angle so he knows where the shooter is, and he grabs a rifle and he shoots the guy.
He did math under pressure, and that's just like,
yeah, it's pretty amazing. And, like, this is his first kill. Like, you can tell, like, once he gets up there and he makes sure that the guy's dead, like, his face, you could tell, like, this is the first time this has happened. And we know that, you know, he had been driving this truck. He hadn't been, like, an active combatant. But when he gets up there, he finds, like, some papers in this guy's notebook or something, and on the guy's person. And he puts it in his jacket before everybody else gets up there, instinctively almost.
Okay.
And then it like switches back and we see Hardison still sneezing.
And he's whining.
Yeah, because he's been forced to go back to the Hall of Records again to find out about Dorothy. So we find out that Dorothy passed away 3 years previously, and she'd lived in this town her whole life. And her daughter lives in her old house. And Sophie's like, oh, I can work with that. and we find out that she worked at the roller rink, like, for most of her life as well. So I love Sophie's like, okay, got that. Let's go.
Like, as a grifter, that's all the information she needs.
Yeah, she's like, oh, I'm good, I'm good. Because I also wonder if she was bored up until that point. Like, she hadn't done anything yet. Come on, just hanging out in this hospital. Need something to do. And then we get another flashback, and we see that McCloskey, who's the guy that was freaking out when they were under fire,
and hiding behind them.
Yeah, is being praised and is probably going to get a Bronze Star for killing that German sniper and saving people's lives. And Charlie is understandably upset because he did that. Like, he should be getting the accolades and the, you know, acclaim for this, but because he's Black, he's not going to be. And, like, just watching that, like, it's so upsetting, and he's so angry, and it just makes you think, like, how many, like, Black soldiers in World War II did heroic things like that and never got any
the credit.
Recognition. Yeah.
And I just thought it's so interesting how Christian was playing that scene, like from moment to moment, like, he was mm-hmm. like, yeah, of course, that's what I had to do, like, there's no way you're gonna get this job. But at the end of it, he's like, I'm sorry,
this is how
part it is. Of him, like, was like, sorry, I'm sorry, I know it sucks, but
yeah, I can't do it. And he even says, he's like, we're almost out of this, do you want to ruin your life by, like, causing a big stink about this?
Especially when there's no way, we already know how it's going to end. Like, there's no good outcome for you.
Yeah.
You know.
But, like, you know, he's still complicit in it. And when he leaves, his look on his face is, like, kind of disgusted with himself, too. And then Charlie, like, goes back to the truck and... So in the commentary, they said that they did a couple takes of this, and the first one or two, they had Aldis, like, just, like, throw things and, like, actually have, like, a breakdown, like, because he's so angry and so upset, which makes total sense, right? Uh-huh. Then for, like, the last take, they asked him, like, okay, how would your mom want you to react? And that's how we want you to do this take. And so he, like, is so angry, but then, like, before he explodes, he, like, contains it, and he, like, puts down his helmet, and he's, like, picks something else up, and then, like, sets it down gently so he doesn't break things. And it's, that is worse. Like, that's more painful for me to watch than to, like, you know, physically destroy things, because he, like, is so upset, he's so angry.
Like, he knows he can't. He knows he needs to clamp it down. He knows he needs to get a hold of himself.
It's like, you have to, yeah, don't be an angry Black man. Like, internalize it. Like,
he needs to swallow it.
And yeah. It's conceal, don't feel. Not to bring Frozen into it, but, you know.
God.
And yeah, so it's so upsetting. But he, remembers, as he's, like, sitting there kind of stewing, the note that he took off the German soldier. So he gets it out, and I love this. He's like, I speak English and I speak French, so German's not hard to figure out. Which,
no,
no.
now if you're saying look, I've learned French, so Spanish isn't that hard to pick up. Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Same roots. Both Romanians, like, your same roots. German is a whole different story.
Other thing. Well, there are a lot of things in German and English that are cognates, so that they do have similar things. But no, because I took German for 7 years. 7 years? 5 years? 5 years. And yeah, I don't think it helped when I was trying to learn French at all. But we do know that Charlie takes up languages easily, and if he has been fighting the Germans for a while, he's probably had, you know, he's heard some
German. A bit of German, right? Of course.
So he's able to figure out what this letter is about, and it's from a soldier to his girlfriend saying, you know, he's got this painting that's gonna, you know, solve their problems, and they won't have to worry about money.
Moment, like, well, and because of me, he's never going to see his wife or his sweetheart again because of
yeah.
me.
Yeah. Yeah. So he, yeah, that was like, ouch. And so he goes into the tent and he grabs the painting and he says he realizes he didn't have to be a hero to get Dorothy. He had the painting and now he has a plan, and you're just like, oh my God, he just wanted to be a hero. And he was a hero, and that avenue was closed to him. And so now needs must.
Like I defy him to turn down someone with a pocket full of cash. Exactly. You know, and like, oh baby, oh sweetie, that's not how this works.
Right.
You could be richer than God himself, and her daddy is still not gonna come around.
Exactly. Like yeah. And she doesn't care if you have money. So then we go back to the present. And Sophie is meeting Dorothy's daughter, who is darling. Like, she's just this very sweet woman. And, you know, she's, I don't think it's actually the case, but Sophie's telling her that they're going to tear down the skate palace. Mm-hmm. And she's like, oh, every time, you know, my mom played the Wurlitzer there for 50 years. And every time someone tried to tear it down, she would sit at that desk and she would write a letter and she would campaign and make sure they didn't tear it down.
I feel like Dorothy was one of those nice white ladies who actually used her powers for good.
Oh, yeah. I think later, definitely.
Yeah.
I want to talk about Dorothy more in a minute.
Yes.
And Dorothy's daughter is like, oh, I'm sorry. Like, your accent is just reminding me of my Aunt Cecilia. She was a war bride. And you're just like, yes, bring it all back. How are we going to make Sophie into this story? And then we get to go back in time again, and Cecilia is playing the Wurlitzer, and Dorothy is skating around. In the commentary, this is the first time we've really seen her skate. Beth Rescrap was like, yeah, they don't have brakes. Like, these skates don't have, like, you know, the front brakes on roller skates?
Okay.
The toe brakes. So, like, if you lean forward, there's, like, a big metal stopper that'll, like, stop you from going anymore. Those don't exist, and she was used to that, so she, like, instinctively tried to brake, and she, like, fell over several times.
Oh, poor Beth.
Yeah, but she, like, you know, she skated around and stuff. And that's, like, when Charlie gets back and he sees her and he says, when I saw her again, it looked like she was floating. She's just skating around.
And then, like, Sophie has, like, this more smooth, polished, like, flimmy, like, posh accent. But Celia, I think, has, like, a harder, more working class, like, British accent, I feel like.
And it's subtle, but, yeah, it's definitely there. Yeah. I love that. So, back in the present, Hardison calls Dorothy's daughter to distract her with, like, some false payments on her credit card. Like, oh, did you buy a jet ski? And, like, a horrible...
It was, like, a borderline, like, problematic, like, Indian accent. And, like, borderline problematic inappropriate.
Yeah, I'm like, no. Don't need to do that.
Yeah.
But she goes off, and Sophie snoops around in Dorothy's old desk, and she finds a key to a safe deposit box. So, and I love this scene. So Nate's like, all right, now I get to do something finally. So he's like, I want Hardison, Sophie, like, you guys go find out what's in the box. Elliot, back him up. Parker, just keep listening. And then that's all Nate does for a minute. But they go, they go to the bank, and it's this beautiful, like, continuous scene where Hardison is doing something to a phone box on a telephone pole, and then he closes it. He has this nice suit on. He turns around, walks past Elliot, meets up with Sophie, like, hands Elliot a phone, and they both walk into the bank. And they have badges that say they're from the FDIC, and that this bank is, like, failed all these stress tests and they need to see everything. And the guy's like, what? I didn't hear about this. So they have him call their home office in DC and it gets picked up by Ellie.
And again, like, Ellie's kind of like, this is not going to Dupree.
Yeah. He's just pulling a name out of nowhere. He's like, yes.
Again, like, he's not putting in the character work.
Well, he doesn't really need to. Then he immediately puts this man on hold. Because he sees some other guy that he knows. And it's Randall, because that's the name of retrieval specialist, Randall. And he's like, he apparently stole Paul McCartney's guitar in Taiwan or something.
I mean, and look, if some dude owes $27,000 and I see him, we're going to need to have a discussion. That's all I'm going to say.
He's like, or we could just split this and we each have $5 million. He's like, nope. Should have paid me. Now I'm going to beat you up. And cutaway.
Like, Sophie and Carson are listening in the comms and they're just like wincing at all the bones and the sounds and the grunts and the hits.
But like, the bank guy is just like listening to hold music.
And then like, there's this look between the two of them was like, was this really necessary, Elliot? Like, really now of all times? You just need like a 10-minute break to go beat some dude up? Like, really, Elliot?
It's stress relief for him. You gotta let him get that out. Or he'll act out later if he doesn't.
And honestly, like I said, look, if some dude owes you $27,000, you do what you gotta do.
Right? Exactly. So back in the past, Charlie has told Dorothy about the painting and he's like, I want to run away with you. And he's like, yeah, I'm totally down with that. Like, let's go. But they can't just leave in the middle of the day. And so they decide that they're going to leave while, because she's supposed to be playing a show the next night.
Playing the world. The whole town's going to be there.
Yeah.
So they can make a clean getaway. Exactly. Celia is going to be their backup. Like, she's going to help them.
Yeah. And she's like, why couldn't you just go? Like, why did you just sneak out? And he's like, with what? Like, neither of us had a car. Her dad owned the whole town. We wouldn't have made it to the county line. So they had to sneak out and they get Cecilia to help them. But Mr. Ross definitely knows something is up and he sends his goons to look for Charlie. And I love he's, like, down under the bridge, like, marking the times when the train goes by so he knows when it's coming. Like, that's so smart, Charlie. Yeah. And then he's ambushed by Ross and his goons. In the commentary, they talk a lot about how this episode feels more like a movie than just an episode. And it's really cinematic. And John talks about wanting each scene to be like a still, like you want it to, each scene to be beautiful. And I'm really struck, like these scenes in the dark where Charlie's like being held up by the goons and by Ross are just like, they are really pretty. Like how the shots are composed, the lighting, it's very...
And just... The structure of the episode itself was very cinematic with these dual time, like the back and forth, the costuming, and like, and I think the way they differentiate between the 40s flashback with the lighting, you know, and things like that. There's almost like a filter and like, there's a bit of like a hazy glow, of the past kind of deal going on.
Yeah. Yeah, and when they're in France, it's almost like blue tones, like, yeah.
Yes.
So, I, you know, let's see, where are we at? Oh, Cecilia and Dorothy trade places, and the sheriff who had seen...
like, a very seamless, like, switcheroo, by the way. Almost like mid-note, and then... Celia just like slides right in. It takes timing.
I also think that the Wurlitzer, having the Wurlitzer music, that also like really gives it each timeline like its own different feeling.
Yeah.
Because that Wurlitzer is so old fashioned sounding. But the before
and then
she
when it plays, it's just like the sound, it just like bursts out and fills to the rafters, and it's like really glorious. Like you can just picture what that's like on a Sunday in a church with like a choir, and just like it'd be magnificent.
Mm-hmm. But as Dorothy tries to get out, the door that she's trying to leave through is locked because Sheriff, not Nate, has been suspicious, and he doesn't like that they've involved his wife in whatever shenanigans they're getting up to.
I mean, which fair, fair.
But, I mean, come on, it's Charlie. And, you know, she's, like, beside herself. She's like, did you tell my dad? And he's like, no, I didn't tell your dad. I'm not a narc. But she's like, I have to go. I have to go to him. And Charlie tricks the goons. He's like, okay, we were going to take your car. The keys are in my bag. And one of the guys, like, pulls out a grenade. And Charlie pulls the pin on the grenade and runs away. And it turns out it's the dud from earlier, which he kept.
Which they call a pineapple. I mean.
Yeah. It looks like a little pineapple.
Yes.
Oh, so then he makes his escape, and then he catches up to Dorothy. And this scene is so beautiful because she's standing under this light, under the bridge, in this glorious yellow cloak that Nadine Hayter made. She like made that cloak herself.
Damn.
Yeah. And it's beautiful. I like yellow is like probably my favorite color. And I'm like, oh, so glorious. And but just as they like meet up, the bad guys show up and they're caught. But then Sheriff Not Nate comes out of nowhere and he shoots at them with his gun and distracts the goons. And they make a run for it and they're about to like jump on to the train.
Mm.
And he's like, we're going to go. We'll like, we'll get off and we'll get tickets somewhere else. And we'll, you know,
yes,
we'll escape. And your dad,
he's like, we can still do this, baby. We can still do this.
Yeah. And she says, no, we can't. Oh. And he said, you know, he'll come get us. And he's like, I can take care of myself. And she says, I know you can, but I can't. And then she's like, this place, this town, it's my home. Like, I can't leave. It's so heartbreaking. And so he like gives her the painting and she's trying to tell him no.
But you can tell this was coming because yeah, this was all she knew. She's afraid. Like he's always seen he's seen the world. She's never left her hometown.
Yeah.
She's scared. She's not ready. She can't do it.
Yeah.
And like, he's always dreamed bigger than her, than she has. She's yeah, happy where she is. He's not. He mm-hmm, needs out.
Well, I don't know. I don't think she's happy where she is.
No.
But she's like, it's
the comfort of the familiar.
It's the comfort of the familiar, and it's like she's not been readied for anything else. Like, she's never had to withstand any hardships, and she's been held back from, like,
she's been daddy's princess her whole life. She's always been taken care of.
Yeah.
She's, I think, like, I guess it's, she's being very honest. Like, I'm not equipped to take care of myself. And I think part of her knew is, like, if she does this, she is going to be more of a hindrance than a help. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
And that's, I think that's what's so heartbreaking is, like, the recognizing that and the, her knowing that she can't take care of herself or take care of him if they leave together. But if she stays, that will be her way of taking care of him and keeping him safe.
Like, because if you love them, let them go.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, that's like a really hard thing to do, to like give up your happiness to save someone else. Like, okay, I'm going to start
that's
crying.
True love. Yeah. That is true love.
Yeah. So it feels like it feels like it's being weak because she's like, okay, I'm just going to stay here and be this pampered white lady. But at the same time, she's giving up happiness with, you know, We find out that she doesn't get married in, for like 10 more years. So she waited a long time. She
shows true grit right there. Yeah. What she's made of. And in the beginning, when Danny goes, oh, Charlie describes her as like, she was, you know, she had a mind of her own.
Mm-hmm.
She does. In her way, she's standing up and showing what she's made of.
Yeah.
And it's sad. In a different time and place, they could have been happy together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ah. I know. I'm like, all right, we can't dive too much more into this because I will cry because I, you know, did my last rewatch and I was typing it up crying.
Oh.
Because this part, like, he gives her the painting to keep safe. And then they like kiss, and he like.
It's almost like a promise of someday we will see each other again. This is not goodbye.
Yeah, and he like jumps on the train, and then she's left behind in the mist. And there's like a close up on her, and she's like, she's just sobbing, and she like puts her hand on her face, and part of me's like, you red lipstick, and that's a lace glove that you have on, and now there's gonna be lipstick on it, but.
And the way that she pulled it together until after he left to break down and cry. Because if he had seen her cry, he was not going to leave her.
Yeah. No. Like, I know. Like, Scrap is so good. Like, my heart breaks with her.
Why isn't she more famous? Why isn't she in all the Oscar movies?
She should be in more things.
Yeah.
And then in the present, you know, Parker has just heard all of this and, you know, and he's like, and I never saw her again. She's torn up. And then Charlie kind of like ponders. He's like, maybe the painting is cursed. That German soldier thought it was going to be the answer for him and his girl. I thought it was going to be the answer for me and my girl. Like, maybe it just shouldn't be found. Maybe it's cursed.
Like the Hope Diamond. Just should not be messed with. Yeah.
And then we find out he didn't even come back for the painting. He came back because he wanted to see her. And he, you know, he says, I had a remarkable life, but I wanted to see her again. And I didn't even know if she would want to see me. And I just came back 3 years too late.
Oh.
You're just like, oh.
They're like star-crossed lovers.
Yes.
This is the version of Romeo and Juliet I can get behind, because as far as I'm concerned, Romeo and Juliet were just stupid hormonal teenagers who let their sex drives get a whole better look. No. These two people loved each other.
Yeah.
This is a tragic love story.
Yeah. So Sophie and Hardison are at the bank and they find the safe deposit box, and it has like a ton of money in small bills. So they're like, so Sophie thinks, you know, she sold the painting and this is what's left of the money. Mm-hmm. But Nate's like, nope, I know exactly.
The parents are so cynical in this episode. They're like, they were suspicious of Dorothy. They're suspicious, like they were saying, Dorothy probably like sold the painting and stuff like that. They had no faith in Dorothy.
Well,
the parents are very cynical.
I mean, and they're hearing the story, but they're not sitting right across from the guy telling it.
Yeah.
You know, they're not us and Parker. So they're just working the case. But Nate's like, nope, I know exactly where it is. I know where the painting is.
Of course he does.
He and Elliot meet at the rink, and they like find one of the keys of the Wurlitzer is broken. And it's inside the pipe of the Wurlitzer. I love. That's so good.
Like you said, it all comes together. That was her happy place. That was her safe place. She played there for years. And the flashback.
Her memories of him.
She worked backwards from Dorothy and figured out. That is, and when the daughter was like, mom would fight tooth and nail forever who wanted anyone to like close down the rink, and now we know why.
Yeah. Yeah, it wasn't just because it had special memories. It's because it literally held something precious.
I mean, it's not like you can just, like, she can just retrieve it and, like, steal away with the painting. Like, it's stuffed inside the painting.
Yeah. So, Elliot, you know, hands down...
The question is, I'm sure it had to be maintained over the years. So how did they make sure, like, the Oregon pipe cleaners or something, they get a hold of it?
I don't know, because she said that the lady who they talked to about the broken key said, oh, it's just always been like that. And the lady who played just it
worked around. So I guess she can work around. It's not a big deal, I guess.
I mean, she might have taken it out whenever the cleaners were coming. If she worked there for 50 years, she knew when they were coming to clean it.
Like a yearly maintenance thing. They always come around July, so at the end of the year, let me get in there, yeah.
If they could afford to have it clean every year.
This is a good point, too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But when Nate takes the painting out...
After explaining how he, you know, cracked... into, like, mind-read Dorothy and figured out where she would hide it.
No, he says that later.
Oh.
I think so.
Yeah.
But we have the reveal of the bad guy.
Yes.
He looks at the painting, and then we see that the bad guy who's hired these goons is actually Owen, the guy from IYS who's been searching for it.
This was his Moby Dick.
Yes. And, you know, Nate's like, hey, you know what? Charlie thinks this thing is cursed. Like, maybe you don't want this because it also made you lose everything. And he's like, no, I need it. Blah, blah. And he's like, all right, well, I just want you to know why I'm doing this. And he lights the tube, like the rolled up painting on fire. And I love, Elliot jumps down from the little balcony where the organ pipes are. And, like, hits the two goons with the pipe, and it makes, like, a different tone. He's like, dong, 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 and then he, like, bong on it, and he's like, oh, that's pretty cool. Like,
interesting. And he's like, this is more like it, not some little plastic pink bat, you know?
He was okay with the bat. That's what I want to... assure everybody that
he was okay.
Elliot did not feel emasculated with the pink bat. That was all Frank and his toxic masculinity.
Well, yes, that impressed her.
Really secure with the pink bat.
The pipe, like, this pipe is pretty cool. It makes cool.
It makes a fun noise. Yes. I think Elliot is always excited to make something new into a weapon. Always looking for a new opportunity to stretch and learn something new.
When you stop learning, you die.
Exactly. I love this part, though. Nate says, you know, this painting is about a man going to work, and that's why you loved it to begin with, and now it's, like, ruined you. Mm. He didn't actually burn the painting. He slid the painting into his jacket, burned a different thing. And then they just walk out. Like, they don't call the cops on this guy. They're just like, nope, you just get to be so upset.
Like, and they're no longer afraid. He's like, they, like, don't even consider him a threat. Like,
physically, that guy's not a threat without his goons. And they've been knocked out. So they're fine.
Yeah.
And then we're back in the hospital. And they've given the painting back to Charlie. And, you know, I guess they've determined it's going to go to the Boston Museum of Art, which is weird because they're in Portland, but whatever. And this is when Nate tells Charlie his, like, rationale.
Oh, right.
Because, you know, he'd told Parker that the Roller Palace was important to Dorothy, and you know, he'd already kind of told us that she was loyal and that she was stubborn, and so she watched over it all those years.
Literally.
And the money in the safe deposit box was, like, she'd saved her tips so that one day she could, like, go meet him. And she's like, she didn't hate him and she didn't give up on him.
All these years I was worried she never wanted to see me again, you know, and, like, now I know how she really felt. And just like, oh.
So nice. Then Nate's like, okay, this is my dramatic exit. I'm going. And so he says, you know, you can't possibly know that that's the story. And he says, no, but it's the best story.
And I want, and as far as I'm concerned, it's true.
Oh, no, I think it's true. But also, like, I think that Nate's going to have a lot of ups and downs in this season. And I think that's a really sweet thing for him to do, is to, like, what's the happiest possible ending we can give this guy?
So he can die in pass, like, can die in peace.
Yeah.
Without his days in peace.
Yeah. And then they're, you know, the rest of them are headed out. I love this. Hardison sneezes again, and Elliot gives him an entire box of tissues. Like, everybody else has just come, like, one tissue. He's just like, which I know in a second we're going to have, like, a whole Parker Hardison moment, but, like, I'm like, Elliot loves him too, okay?
That's his bro. They bro it out. They bro it out. They bro it.
Well, they also do a little complicated handshake thing.
Yes.
I don't think it's the handshake. Oh, man, I gotta go back and watch. But it was a little complicated handshake. And then, you know, as she's about to leave, Charlie catches Parker's arm, and he tells her, like, don't waste time. And she, like, smiles at Hardison, and they, like, hold hands. And it's, like, it's what you were saying earlier. He sees in them what could have been for him and Dorothy if they hadn't been, you know, products of their time. And it's really wonderful. And it's still not easy for biracial couples to be together, but it's much easier than it used to be when it was illegal. That's the Being Go job, and it was really good.
It was.
And I love it. I love a time travel, like, back in time, seeing characters that we normally see in one era. Like,
I mean, and Beth gave a hell of a performance.
She did, and so did Aldis. Like, yeah. So I do have a heist-related book recommendation.
Yay!
It is called... Do I not have Goodreads on my iPad? That's not what it's called. It's called Diamond Doris, and it is a memoir of a woman in the... she started in the 60s, I want to say. And she, like, went all the way to, like, present day almost.
Wow.
She's, like, the premier jewel thief. Okay, so her name is Doris Marie Payne. The book is her memoir. So she, like, wrote it with, like, a, like, kind of like a ghostwriter. And it's a really easy read. So she grew up during the Depression in, like, coal country, and her dad was really abusive to her mom, and she, like, from a young age, and she was, like, the youngest of a large family, from a young age was like, I am never going to have a man treat me the way that my husband, my dad treats my mom. And she's also from a really young age, like, aspired to greatness, and she would, like, read magazines and see beautiful jewelry on the models. And she was like, that's what I want. And so she learned pretty quickly that she could be charming and distract people. And she would go into jewelry stores, and she would confuse them out of jewelry. She becomes like this world-class jewel thief. Like, she travels around the world doing this. Also, she's a Black woman during the 60s doing this.
All right, now.
It's amazing. And she refuses to, like, get married to anybody. She has several, like, long-term boyfriends, but she, like, doesn't let them sleep at her house.
She's like, I like her.
Yeah, she had two kids, but she's just like sends them off to live with other people. Like, she's also like upfront about like, I wasn't fit to be a good mom at that time. So they went and lived with their dad, or they went and lived with their other families. but she like the whole time like supports her mom, because she's like, I just want my mom to be happy and to be healthy and to like have money and not be poor. Aww. She's like,
she's wily. Pretty badass.
Yeah, and she's like unapologetic about it too. She's like, yeah, I'm gonna take advantage of these people because they think that I'm, you know, just some black lady who doesn't deserve anything, and I'm gonna take it. And she's I'm gonna take it right out from under their noses. It's really good. So
very yeah, cool.
That's my heist light, Diamond Doris.
You're gonna throw a link in the show notes, right?
Yes.
Awesome.
Yeah. I wish the only downside is like I wish there were more photos of her in the book. The cover is really pretty, and it's the photo of I guess there was like a made-for-TV movie about her life. And it's the actress who plays her on the cover, and the cover is gorgeous. And then there's a picture of her on the back cover, and she's still gorgeous on the back. But I wish there'd been more pictures of her throughout her life, because she would like get arrested, but then like get out of jail because her boyfriend was like a Jewish mobster, and they would just like pay off the judges and stuff. It was like, you're like, oh my God,
that is a fascinating life.
Yeah. And part of her is like, she's like, you know what? They're stealing these diamonds off the backs of African people who are basically in slavery in Africa. So I have every right to take these diamonds. I am black.
Let's call them reparations.
Exactly.
I'm doing this for my people.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. She's like, this is a political statement. Yeah. But yeah, that's my high slight.
Awesome.
Okay, let's see. So in 2 weeks, we'll be back. We'll be doing the potato job. I love the potato job. And Tara's going to be on that one again.
Ooh.
Tara Kennedy will be back. So, Lisa, tell people where they can find you on the internet.
I'm at LaForesta1. You can find me on Twitter, and I apologize in advance because since December 23rd, I probably used the F word on my Twitter feed more than like the previous 12 months combined, but there were extenuating circumstances and I'm trying to do better, and I am good on the cats and boxes gifts. So we're good.
Don't act like anybody but me ever sent you anything. I feel like a lot of people who listen to this podcast are in Romancelandia, and so they will totally understand the amount of F-bombs.
Yes. And and I will be back for the graveyard job in a couple more weeks.
Yeah. So exciting. I love season 4. You can find me on Twitter at LibrariansD. And yeah, you won't see us again, but you'll hear us again in 2 weeks for the potato job.
Fun. Bye, y'all.
Bye.
Just jealous of anyone who can pull off yellow, because it does not go well with my skin tone. It just does not do pretty things. And it's generally, I just feel like yellow is a hard color to pull off.
Lisa, I've moved on.
Oh, sorry!
I just talked about Sheriff Not Nate.
Oh my God, it's like, I don't know why, but this is slowing, so that's the last part I heard. I'm sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead. That was my bad.
I'm like, that was like a minute ago.
Yes, I'm putting it out there. Yellow is not my friend.